Hello.
Dominic, it's my turn. You always do it. Yes. Bog off.
I think they should broadcast this.
Hello, and welcome to the bonus episode of The Rest is History with me and my very rude partner, colleague.
I saw I was being referred to somewhere as your sidekick recently, which I took great offence at.
Well, wasn't that just... That was in the episode that we've just recorded, isn't it, about Tolkien? I began it with... well, I'm not going to spoil it for people, but we've just recorded two episodes on Tolkien, and it begins with an account of my journey to Oxford to meet with Dominic.
Yeah.
And people were asking, was a special episode being recorded? It wasn't. Basically, we were meeting up because I have finished my book. Woo-hoo! Hooray!
So we'll never hear of that book ever again.
Never again. So I finished it on the Thursday evening, and I went up to meet with Dominic on the Friday. And yeah. You will find out when you listen to the Tolkien episode what we didn't go and see. But we were also, we were mapping out our plans for the World Cup episodes, weren't we? And other episodes that we got coming up. And then we went and did some publicity shots in front of the Bodleian, which was quite funny.
It was very funny, yeah. Well, you put that up on Twitter, didn't you? And somebody said, you know, is that the entrance to Wikipedia or something? Well, I've never heard of that website, so I didn't know what they were talking about.
what are they talking about?
Sam, backroom guru, says, were you recording a special episode? Did Dominic revisit any of his old haunts? The answers actually are no. And, well, I did use, so we were photographed, weren't we, Tom, in front of the Radcliffe camera. And I used to go and do my my weekly tutorial reading at the Radcliffe camera. Have you ever worked in the Radcliffe camera?
I have, yeah.
It's lovely. It's a beautiful library, actually, isn't it? It's amazing to be in there.
That's why we're always going to the Bodleian.
Of course, to do our research. So Sam asks you what you think of Oxford compared with your own alma mater, Cambridge. So you're a Cambridge man, of course.
I am, well, at university, but I was born in Oxford.
Of course, yes.
So in a way, it's my natal city.
Is it?
Hmm. So my parents lived there
when
they first married. As you again, you will find out when you listen to the Tolkien episode. My father met Tolkien. So I'm very fond of Oxford. Both my daughters, my eldest has left Oxford,
yep.
but my younger is there at the moment. So no, very, very fond. I love them both.
It's a more worldly city than Cambridge, I think, isn't it, Oxford? Don't you agree? Sort of feels bigger,
yes.
closer to London. Feels psychologically closer to London.
When I was at Cambridge, it was a lot smaller. Kind of icy winds of the Fens sweeping in, but now I mean it feels a faintly sinister place, kind of surrounded by biotech companies.
Yes,
and, you know, go out too far and you suspect they're doing weird things with grass.
When the zombies escape, it'll be at Cambridge.
Well, so 28 Days Later, the film in which a monkey infected with this virus called The Rage gets liberated by animal rights activists and it turns everybody in Britain into a zombie. That laboratory was in Cambridge. And basically all I can say about Cambridge is it does now seem the kind of place where highly dangerous experiments would be conducted.
Those of you living in Cambridge will enjoy the beginning of this podcast.
I love it as well.
Now, Tom, you also went on a London animals walk over the weekend. So what was this? This was one of your history walks.
Well, I know how to celebrate. So obviously, I went for a 20-mile walk around London.
Your poor wife on this walk.
She was a very willing participant, although she did start to flag after about 15 miles. Basically, I hadn't had much exercise because I hadn't done, you know, I'd been very stationary and sedentary for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I hadn't played any cricket since the tour of Cornwall. I haven't really done anything. And I just felt I needed some exercise. And so, Dominic, as you know, I do enjoy these themed walks across the great capital. And I thought it'd be fun to do an animal-themed one. So we've got a stable in Brixton, which is brilliant, the Ebony Riding School. So we went down and saw them. And we went to what actually turned out, because I'd misread the webpage, but I thought was a place where they had the first giraffe. It turned out to be in Woolworth. But we were vaguely the same right area. Went to Elephant and Castle. So it's a big famous kind of image of an elephant.
Oh, right. I mean, do people walk voluntarily to Elephant and Castle? Maybe they do.
Oh, no, it's famously horrible. But you've got to have the horrible bits to deserve the nice bits. Went to the Tower of London for the reasons that people have listened to our episode on the menagerie in London.
Yeah.
That saw a number of animal sculptures. So Hodge, Dr. Johnson's cat, which Dr. Johnson loved. It's in Gough Square. There's a building that has the smallest work of public sculpture in London, which is two mice fighting over a lump of cheese on the side of an office block in the city. Went to London Zoo. Went to the memorial to the animals who got the animal equivalent to the VC.
Yeah, in the Second World War.
Have you come across that?
I think I've seen it online.
It's brilliant. So do you know which animal got the most VCs?
Pigeons. Is that a counted animal?
Yeah, it was pigeons. It was pigeons, followed by dogs, followed by horses, when there was one cat. I'd love to know what the cat did.
Cats are very poor performers.
Yeah. So if anyone knows what the cat did to earn the animal equivalent of the VC, but also it had a list of the people who'd contributed funds to pay for this, and it was kind of fairly obvious. So there was Pedigree, who make dog food.
really?
Various kind of animal organizations like that. Jilly Cooper.
Yeah, she's a great animal lover.
And Charlie Watts, the late Charlie Watts.
Of the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. So Jilly Cooper, for those who don't know, she writes some very racy novels, generally against a backdrop of horses and racing. Yeah. Though I gather that she is currently writing a novel about footballers. Do you know what it's called? And I don't know whether this is true.
Balls. Go on.
Tackle.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Well,
I don't know.
Be looking forward to that with bated breath.
Anyway, so dusted off some cobwebs. It was kind of like a holiday. It was the kind of holiday that you would have hated. It was earnest, prune drinking holiday. It was good for me.
Golly, you're really selling it to me, Tom.
I'm not asking you to do it.
No. I mean, did you drink any seawater?
No, we didn't.
No percussion douches? No gas injections?
No. We ended up in a pub. I think it was called the Garden Horseman, which was by Trafalgar Square. And, you know, you'd never go to a pub by Trafalgar Square. It was great. Had pictures of horses everywhere.
Sounds absolutely brilliant.
It was,
so,
Dominic.
Tom, it was. Sam also asks about the Empire podcast. So this is our new sister podcast with William Dalrymple and Anita Anand, and it's all about empires.
We love to see other podcasts do well, don't we, Dominic?
Do we? I mean, you do.
Yeah, we love it. We're so happy for their success.
How do we view the new challenger, says Sam? Do we see it as a betrayal after Dalrymple's appearance on our podcast, or do we see it as a surrogate child? I think we wish them all the best, don't we, Tom?
We do. Yes, we do.
We hope they do well, but we hope they don't do better than us. I think that's...
Yeah. Obviously, I'm just a much nice person, so I don't care.
Oh, that's a lie. So, talking of the Empire, we had a few questions because the 16th of August, says Malcolm Mann, was the 134th anniversary of T.E. Lawrence's birth.
That's an anniversary that passed me by. Did it pass you by?
It did, I'm afraid. Malcolm says, I may be wrong, but I think he was scheduled to be the subject of a Rest His History episode. I hope he'd be a friend of the show, but he's such an enigmatic character and he's hard to get into his head. And Tony Bang says he's recently been watching Lawrence of Arabia. I couldn't make out by the end if he was a hero or if it was a story of a descent into madness and bloodlust. So, Tom, we have talked about doing Lawrence of Arabia. I think we've had it possibly in the schedule and then put it off for various reasons.
We were going to do it, and then we decided to do General Gordon instead.
That's right, yeah.
So we were going to do Lawrence, and then you said Gordon would be a more interesting subject, and I think you were right.
Well, I think we'd probably done a lot of 20th century, so we did Gordon. T.E. Lawrence would be a brilliant subject for the Rest Is History, because, of course, he's not only a historical character, but he was very interested in history and in Crusader castles and all those things. So there's an awful lot to talk about with him and about the birth of the modern Middle East, about his role in the First World War, about his character. As Malcolm says, he's a very strange and intense character. I'm sure we will do T.E. Lawrence. I'm sure he would be two episodes, by the way, as General Gordon was. Have you seen Lawrence of Arabia, Tom?
I have, years ago.
Do you like it? Or do you think it was very, very long?
I thought it was very long. I thought it was. I can't really remember anything about it except that opening shot.
Yeah.
And I seem to, it's so long ago, I may even be imagining it, but I had thought that there was a thing where he gets whipped.
Yeah, very famous.
Was that in it? Or had it been cut? I can't remember.
I think it is in it. It's the most famous incident of his career. He goes off on this sort of lone... He's got his group of Arab sort of resistance fighters and they're holed up in their base. And he decides to go off on his own to do this sort of reconnaissance at a place called, I think it's called Dera or Dara. And he is captured there and he's dragged before the kind of Turkish governor. And then there's a, Lawrence describes what happened, and it's very unclear whether or not, whether he was beaten, whether he was raped. And then he's abandoned kind of naked and bleeding, you know, on the floor of this sort of cell, and he manages to escape. A kind guard helps him to escape. And people have discussed this ever since. They've said, did it really happen? Is it a kind of weird wish fulfillment?
Yeah.
Is it a fantasy? Does it tell us something about Lawrence's sexuality, about his sort of tortured psyche, or is it simply a straightforward account of what happened?
Le vice anglais.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Is it? I mean, there's that sort of sense that when Lawrence describes it, he's relishing the sadism of it. I think that's what people have sometimes found unsettling in his description. Anyway, I mean, I'm just talking off the cuff. I haven't really thought about this.
But we will do it.
But as you can tell, it's a really interesting subject for a podcast. So holidays, a shocking question from Jonathan Allen, Tom. Have you seen this?
Yes. So Jonathan Allen, this is on Twitter. I hope that you, Dominic, would regale us with his tales of his 18 to 30 foam party holidays, to which you have sternly and very correctly replied, only paying members of the Rest is History Club get that kind of premium content. So,
yeah.
So all of you listening, that's what you get. So Dominic, you got to tell them about your foam party holidays now. Did you have any?
What is a foam party?
I think it's kind of...
I don't really know what a foam party is.
It's
a lot of bubble bath, basically.
Yes, it's people soaping each other with bubble bath.
Have you ever seen the Peter Sellers film The Party, where he plays Mr. Bakshi, an Indian actor who's invited by accident to a Hollywood mogul's party?
I don't think that's what it's like.
It's an absolutely excellent film, probably cancelable now, but it's an excellent film. And at the end, he releases a foam machine, and everybody's covered in foam, and it's a brilliant ending to the film.
I think it's more kind of.
It's more debauched than that.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, club night, but in the kind of setting that would be, you'd get on Love Island. So it's kind of people running around, soaping each other.
What did they do again, Tom? What was that noise? So Sam says, do we have foam party-esque holiday stories, the weirdest or wildest holiday? I can tell you the weirdest holiday I've been on, and that was a holiday in Belarus.
It has featured, hasn't it?
Has that come up before?
Yes, it has. You have mentioned it. And the terrible chocolate.
Chocolate, yeah. The chocolate tasted like dust, and a pizza restaurant where there were only two pizzas on offer, the pizza of the owner and the pizza of the devil, as they were called. And I think we ordered the pizza of the devil, as you would.
And was that the right choice?
Yeah, I think it was a good choice. It was a really good choice. I'm still alive anyway. Incitatus, Tom.
Do you not want to hear the weirdest or wildest holiday I've been
on? Oh, yeah, sorry. I didn't assume you'd ever been on any weird or wild holidays.
So the weirdest stretch of holiday was where I ended up involved with drug running in the India-Pakistan desert that separates them.
Wow, this is a lot better than eating pizzas in Belarus.
There's this place called Jaisalmer, which is this very romantic city out in the desert wilds of Rajasthan, and you can take camel safari. So I signed up for camel safari, went out with this guy who very rapidly came clear was that I was the front for his drug smuggling.
Oh no.
And we ended up going for 3 days rather than the 4 hours that I'd signed up for.
What? So how could that possibly have happened? What were you a hostage or something? Or a willing accomplice?
I was in the middle of a desert. I didn't have any other way of getting back. I didn't know how to ride a camel.
So after the first day when you just sort of said, oh, well.
We all just camped out in the stars. And I thought, well, have I inadvertently signed up for
4 weeks?
Yeah. I mean, I could have done. So I had no idea what was going on. It was absolutely terrible.
Oh, dear.
So it's the weirdest and wildest. I'd much rather, you know, there was no foam at all. So
no, that sounds bad. All right. So Incitatus has a question. You touched on the influence of the Grand Tour on architecture. So this is in our holiday podcast. So the first one of which was on the Grand Tour. But isn't its influence much greater? It created an international elite class of people immersed in classical art, architecture and thought, which led in some countries such as Russia to a ruling class completely out of touch with and with different values from its inhabitants. One of the causes, says Incitatus, of the Russian Revolution. Tom, do you think the Russian Revolution was caused by the Grand Tour?
I don't know enough about the Russian Revolution. Was it?
I think Inkatarsis actually has a point, which is that...
Well, they all spoke French, didn't they, in Russia?
What you absolutely had in 19th century Russia, I don't think this was a result of the Grand Tour, but I think what you definitely had in 19th century Russia was a class of people who, as you say, spoke French and did not see themselves as having... I mean, they did sort of see themselves as a bit of a sort of cosmopolitan aristocratic elite floating above the great mass of the Russian peasantry and serfs.
But then there were the Slavophiles, weren't there?
Who, yes, of course, you're right.
Who went the opposite way.
So I'm simplifying hugely. But I think you did have, in Russia in particular, people who saw themselves as belonging to a sort of European elite and having more in common with other aristocrats abroad than with their own serfs. Don't you, Tom?
And Dominic, does that hold a mirror up to Brexit?
Oh, God. I was actually trying very hard not to use the expression citizens of the world and citizens of nowhere. I was deliberately not trying
I punched a hole through that paper.
So the holidays, let's just talk a little bit about the holidays. So we ended up doing four episodes. I think we'd planned one or something. I can't remember. And then I thought they were, I mean, obviously I'm reviewing our own podcast, which is a very bad form. But I really enjoyed doing them, didn't you? I thought it was such a fun subject.
Yeah, I hugely enjoyed doing them.
I mean, we were lucky because of Lucy Lethbridge's book
came out just the right time, the weekend before we recorded it.
Yeah. And actually, we have been in touch with her, haven't we, to say, you know, thank you for writing such a great book that we were able to tell all the great stories from. And she's coming on the podcast because she wrote in 2013, I think it was, or 2014, a brilliant book, which I also reviewed, about domestic service. And with some amazing stories and statistics, actually, about the number of people who worked as domestic servants before the First World War. And obviously, it's the single biggest employer of women in sort of pre-World War era Britain. So it's a great chance for us to tell the stories of people who don't often appear in history podcasts, so working class women and so on. And I'm sure she'll be absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's something to look forward to.
Sam the Burgundian.
Yes.
I have only been through the first episode, but isn't it a bit radical to just throw out pilgrimages as a medieval form of holidays? On what grounds? They were actually more democratic than the Grand Tour, but also consisted of people traveling just for the sake of bettering or redeeming themselves. If in any way I implied that there was not a sacral element to the pilgrimage, I certainly did not intend to.
That sounds very implausible that you would imply that, Tom.
We talked about it in the context of Chaucer.
We did. I don't think it's unfair to throw out pilgrimages as holidays. I think people, you know, trustafarians like Tom going to India.
Give me trustafarians. The work I did. There's a car park outside Salisbury. And every time I pass it, I think, God, the work I did on that.
What did you do?
I had to fill gabions. Do you know what gabions are?
No.
Gabions are wire mesh. They're kind of wire mesh cages. And you have to fill them with rocks. And then they use them to build up banks on rivers. So basically, we've talked about... Mordor and Saruman and everybody in Lord of the Rings destroying beautiful rivers. That's what I did. I was an
orc. You were damming rivers.
I was an orc. Yeah, for about four months. Then I worked on a winery, which was awful.
Tom, working in a winery doesn't sound like a great hardship. What were you doing? Tramping down the...
No, you have to harvest grapes. You have to kind of go along and you kind of kneel and you either bend over and your back goes, or you kneel and the frost means that your knees are cut to pieces. It's like Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
Golly. And this was to raise money for your Indian drug smuggling trip.
Yeah, I didn't know it was going to be drug smuggling. So none of that trustafarian stuff. I worked incredibly hard. It put me off work.
You never worked again.
And I thought what I want to do when I grow up is I just want to do podcasts. I never have to go outside.
When you went to India, there was a bit of the, surely there must have been a little bit of the pilgrimage.
Yeah, a bit. Yeah. But the real pilgrimage is, for me, there were three places in the world I really, really wanted to go. Rome. Yep. Athens, Jerusalem, and I rationed them.
Deliberately?
Yeah, because I thought, I'm going to be so excited going to all of these. I just don't want to rush it. I don't want to just kind of gorge myself. So they were kind of pilgrimages, yeah.
And which was the best?
I think Rome is the best.
Do you know what, Tom? Of those three, I've only been to Rome. I've never been to Athens, and I've never been to Jerusalem.
I think Rome has the most. It's the most infinite. Athens is the most romantic.
Even now.
I remember we flew in over Salamis. I could see from the plane window. I could see Salamis below me. And I'd drawn it so many times on all my, you know, as a child drawing maps of the Battle of Salamis, as one does. I'm possibly giving away too much there. But I was so happy. And there's something about Greece, I was just so happy. I was so happy to go to Athens. And then Jerusalem is intense. And it's like being inside the head of someone with very severe mental problems.
Golly, you're really selling it.
It's quite a tough place because there are lots of very religious Jews, lots of very religious Christians, lots of very religious Muslims, and they're all kind of parallel lines. And the constant sense that if they kind of run into each other, perhaps problems will ensue. There's the Israeli-Palestinian situation where people are taking things very, very seriously. It's all tied in with physical space. So the Temple Mount being the obvious, that it's, you know, it's the holiest place for Jews and it's the third holiest for Muslims, and that's all very tense. There's all the kind of tension around all the various Christian denominations, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and they all hate each other. There's all the various different Christian denominations, and they're all, it's a very, very intense place. I mean, fascinating, but not relaxing.
Do you know, Tom, the place that I had the highest expectations for and I was most anxious about going to and I put most mental and emotional effort into was Disney World by a colossal margin.
And how was that?
So we were meant to go in 2020. And so it had been put off twice because of COVID. And my son was obviously getting older and older. But I had spent so many hours planning it. I mean, just weeks of my life planning it to the nth degree. And everything I read said, however much planning you do, it won't be enough. Do another 6 weeks worth of planning. So I'd completely overhyped it, but I was also terrified that it would be so awful and it would be such a letdown. And it's so expensive. And then when it wasn't and everything worked and we got to see Darth Vader and all these things, I just thought, I could die now. This is brilliant. You know, I've actually done something constructive and fulfilling with my life. Organized a trip to Disney World where it's worked out, and we've come home with the lightsaber and the droid.
Brilliant.
That were the objectives of the exercise.
You're such a good father.
Well,
never did that for my children.
Yeah, but they weren't into expensive commercialized.
But that's only because I hadn't let them be.
Yeah.
They had no idea that it was possible to have any holiday that didn't revolve around visiting ruins.
I love that. My favorite holiday photo I've ever seen from anybody ever is the photo of you dragging your girls to Hadrian's Wall in the pouring rain.
Yeah. And Aunt Sadie.
Yeah. Well, she's very tolerant, isn't she? I mean, that's.
And the weird thing is, so this is the first day of our walk along Hadrian's Wall from Wall's End through central Newcastle. And it just rained all day. And I'd been bigging it up to the girls as a fascinating glimpse of history. I mean, even that they thought was terrible, but they hadn't realized it involved walking through kind of grey suburbs in rain. But then 2 days later, it was so hot we all got heat strokes. So,
oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Fun. Oh.
Well, I know people often say there's nothing more interesting than hearing people talk about their holidays, don't they? So perhaps we should talk about some history. So we've just done two podcasts about J.R.R. Tolkien that we've been looking forward to since the beginning of the whole series. And I think it's fair to say we're massively overprepared. And we said about...
We got overexcited, didn't we?
We said only about 5% in the 2 hours of what we were hoping to say. Because I look at my notes now, which are still on my desk because we did this early this afternoon. And I've wasted vast amounts of time, paper and ink.
I've already thrown mine into the tip and it's been hauled away by the huge lorry that I hired specially to remove.
So what would you have talked about in the Tolkien podcast, Tom, if we'd had a third episode? What would you have liked to have talked about?
I would have liked, so what we didn't talk about that I think is really interesting is the way that we touched on it very fleetingly, but all the historical elements.
All the different trace elements, the
fragments, yeah.
Yes. So we didn't talk about tons of the characters, did we? So I had a whole thing about kingship and about leadership. So Denethor, Theoden, Aragorn, and so on, that I wanted to talk about, comparing them with 1930s figures at the time.
Politicians.
Yeah, when Tolkien was writing, and I didn't get to talk.
So who is Aragorn?
Well, Aragorn is this sort of idealized, late 1930s. It's interesting, isn't it? Because the late 1930s is a period when people think that in the West, leadership has kind of failed. And actually, Denethor, the character Denethor in The Lord of the Rings, says three times in the book the sentence, the West has failed. And I think Aragorn is a sort of idea. He's almost a bit of a, I mean, this is a terrible, terrible cliche, and I'm embarrassed that I'm even saying it, but there's a kind of sense in which he's a Churchillian figure, isn't there? You know, he's sort of, we will fight, and no matter what the odds, we will never surrender. And
he has no sense of humour.
Aragorn?
Yeah. I mean, Churchill was a very funny man.
Yes, I know, but I mean, Churchill wouldn't have fitted into the world of Middle-earth, would he? I mean, no. He was sort of, I mean, the nearest thing to Churchill in Middle-earth is Barlaam and Butterbur, probably. Somebody, you know, that's not a comparison you'll often hear.
No, I think there's no comparison. I don't think that any 1930s politician, I think that's the whole point.
I think the portraits of Denethor and Theoden, who are kings who've lost their resolve, unable to stand against evil, that feels very Age of Appeasement to me. And even if Tolkien doesn't mean it, I think it's, you can sort of see why he would draw those.
Okay, let me rephrase that. I can't see any ideal kings.
In the 1930s. No, and in fact, you could actually say, Tom, couldn't you, that there's something perhaps discomforting about the idea, because you say in the podcast that when it's finally released, you say, you know, Tolkien has this idea of the sacral kingship being the idea of the governing model and stuff.
Sacral.
Of course, sacral. Bingo. But the 1930s is an age when, you know, there are people who say, I am the leader, I am the, you know, you should all follow me. And that's pretty...
Yeah.
And I don't think that would, I mean, Tolkien would be horrified that we'd made this point, that the idea that, you know, there's something slightly fascistic about extolling a single ruler.
Well, he said, and we didn't mention this, but he says something like, I hate Hitler for being an ignorant, lamentable little twerp, or something.
Yes, he does.
Barry
he does
Dad's army, like, because he has corrupted the pure spirit of the North.
He does. Know, he says exactly that. Yeah.
Which is absolutely true. I mean, Hitler has done that. I mean, the legacy of Nazism has completely, you know, it's very difficult to feel romantic about Vikings or Norse knights or anything like that. And I think that perhaps again is another, we touched, you know, we were exploring why Lord of the Rings has been so popular. I think there is a kind of inherent drama and poetry to all that kind of stuff that people feel inhibited about allowing themselves to surrender to, a bit like Wagner, actually. Wagner's operas.
Agreed. I agree completely.
There's a power there that is unmistakable, but you feel nervous about surrendering to it because the Nazis kind of shat all over it, basically.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that also lies behind something that we also touched on at the very end of that episode, which is the current move within American academia there's a great sort of sense of self-flagellation among medievalists, isn't there? Because they say medieval studies, some medievalists, younger medievalists, okay, very radical medievalists say our whole discipline is permeated with white supremacy and right-wing reactionary assumptions, and we have to burn down the whole thing. I mean, they actually use expressions like this on Twitter. We have to burn down the whole thing and start again. And actually, that is a result of the things you're talking about, isn't it?
Well, except I think it's also perhaps a result of stuff that we talked about with Sarah Churchill and the idea of the Confederacy as a land of knights errant and all that Walter Scott stuff. So I think there is a strain there, which I think isn't present in England to the same degree.
Yeah, I think that's... Oh, of course, in England, if you say, I love knights and I love the idea of rescuing maidens from towers and fighting dragons and, you know, being a pure-hearted sort of crusader knight, I think you can actually say that without a hint of...
Well, England football fans go dressed as crusaders. I mean, I know that there's an element of eyebrow raising about that, but it's...
We have talked, have we not, in one of these bonus episodes about the Euro 2016 when... The FA was being in a sort of, or somebody in a very woke moment was wanted England fans not to dress as crusaders. They said, oh, it's very culturally insensitive. You shouldn't do it. And a very, very much loved national newspaper rang me up and said, how do you feel about this? And I said, I feel very strongly about it. I think everyone should dress as crusaders all the time. And I pointed out to them that actually my son had a crusader outfit, and they said, oh, would you like, could we come and photograph him in this crusader outfit and use it as the illustration for the piece? And I asked him what he thought. He was all for it. He was delighted. You know, he couldn't wait because he was what, then five, and he thought he was giving them paper, and it's very exciting. And my wife probably sensibly said, this is an absolutely shameful idea. There is no way I would allow him to be photographed.
I'm completely on Catherine's side. I think it would be a terrible idea.
Yeah. That picture of him as a crusader would have followed him around all his life.
It would be like the guy in the baseball cap in America.
Who's that?
What was he? Was he rude to a Native American or something?
Oh, God, yes, that's right.
He had a MAGA.
Yeah, he had a MAGA hat on. Yeah.
Can't remember the exact limitations, but you wouldn't want something like that.
There's a point at which you're behaving to your children as Jacob Rees-Mogg is to his. As in exactly. Getting them to dress up as yourself.
Exactly. Posting.
But I mean, you do that, Tom, when you post pictures of yourselves at Hadrian's Wall.
Well, it's not like they're dressed as, you know, Picts or something.
No.
They're dressed as bedraggled English tourists having a miserable holiday. And they didn't really need to dress up for that because that's what they were.
No.
Bless them.
Talking of miserable girls, the other thing we didn't talk about Tolkien was talking of women. Because we didn't really talk about that at all, did we?
No, we didn't, no.
Because he gets a lot of stick because he doesn't have many feet. I mean, in The Hobbit, I think, are there any women in The Hobbit? I don't think there are there? Maybe Lobelia Sackville-Baggins. does she
maybe, well, Shelob the spider is female, so maybe one Shelob, of the spiders. Yeah,
but then there's, in The Lord of the Rings, there's Galadriel, there's Eowyn, and there's somebody else who I can't remember.
Well, there's loads.
That's tons.
Oh. Arwen.
But Eowyn is a great character, and Eowyn is very much a female role model.
Athelflaed, yeah. Lady of the
Mercians. Yeah, I mean, she's
Lady of the Mercians.
Yeah. Well, but I think it's fair to say that Tolkien, this would not have occurred really to Tolkien, because he's writing as a boy's own story, isn't he?
Basically.
About male camaraderie. Anyway, yes. We're basically just doing the Tolkien podcast again, and given that we've just done it, and people haven't even heard it yet,
filling in the gaps.
Yeah.
Good. Well, I think that's probably enough.
So we've exhibited our holiday photos. We've talked about a podcast that people haven't even heard. We've covered ourselves generally with glory. I think that's what people look for in these bonus podcasts, isn't it? So what have we got? So we have coming up, we're going to do a couple of episodes about Portugal.
Well, so next week is the Tolkien episodes.
Yes.
Coming up, we have an episode on the Loch Ness Monster.
Oh, yeah, we're recording that on Wednesday.
Yep, so Loch Ness Monster. And what else? I think we're doing French films, are we? History of France through films?
Yes, we're going to be recording episodes about, looking at my diary, about Japan.
Japan, yes.
About German Romanticism.
That's Andrea Wolf's great new book, which has had
very
well
reviews. Yes, it has.
Sounds great fun.
We're going to be recording, doing probably a couple of episodes about the young Churchill, which I imagine will be interesting and colourful, and some excellent impersonations to come in there. And the Ramsay MacDonald, the first Labour Prime Minister, and possibly even Marilyn Monroe might be making her podcast debut. Very exciting, Tom.
Huge excitement, yep.
I know you've got loads to say about Marilyn Monroe, haven't you?
Yeah, I know loads about her.
Of course you do. Right, on that bombshell, we shall see you all next week. Have a great week, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh,